But my neighbor said the Talibs were looking at the big house like, how did he say it? Yes, like wolves looking at a flock of sheep. They told Hassan they would be moving in to supposedly keep it safe until I return. Hassan protested again. So they took him to the street. No, I breathed, and ordered him to kneel. No, God, no. And shot him in the back of the head. No. Farzana came screaming and attacked them. No. Shot her too. Self-defense, they claimed later. But all I could manage was to whisper no, 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 over and over again. I kept thinking of that day in 1974 in the hospital room just after Hassan's hair lip surgery. Baba, Rahim Khan, Ali, and I had huddled around Hassan's bed and watched him examine his new lip in a handheld mirror. Now, everyone in that room was either dead or dying, except for me. Then I saw something else. A man dressed in a herringbone vest pressing the muzzle of his Kalashnikov to the back of Hassan's head. The blast echoes through the street of my father's house. Hassan slumps to the asphalt, his life of unrequited loyalty drifting from him like the windblown kites he used to chase. The Taliban moved into the house, Rahim Khan said. The pretext was that they had evicted a trespasser. Hassan and Farzana's murders were dismissed as a case of self-defense. No one said a word about it. Most of it was fear of the Taliban, I think. But no one was going to risk anything for a pair of Hazara servants. What did they do with Sohrab? I asked. I felt tired, drained. A coughing fit gripped Rahim Khan and went on for a long time. When he finally looked up, his face was flushed and his eyes bloodshot. I heard he's in an orphanage somewhere in Kartese, Amir John. Then he was coughing again. When he stopped, he looked older than a few moments before, like he was aging with each coughing fit. Amir John, I summoned you here because I wanted to see you before I die, but that's not all. I said nothing. I think I already knew what he was going to say. I want you to go to Kabul. I want you to bring Sohrab here, he said. I struggled to find the right words. I had barely had time to deal with the fact that Hassan was dead. Please hear me, Rahim Khan said. I know an American pair here in Peshawar, a husband and wife named Thomas and Betty Caldwell. They're Christians and they run a small charity organization that they manage with private donations. Mostly, they house and feed Afghan children who have lost their parents. I have seen the place. It's clean and safe, and the children are well cared for. And Mr. and Mrs. Caldwell are kind people. They have already told me that Sohrab would be welcome to their home, and... Rahim Khan, you can't be serious, I said. Children are fragile, Amir John, he said. Kabul is already full of broken children, and I don't want Sohrab to become another. Rahim Khan, I don't want to go to Kabul. I can't, I said. Sohrab is a gifted little boy, he said. We can give him a new life here, new hope, with people who would love him. Thomas Agha is a good man, and Betty Khanum is so kind. You should see how she treats those orphans. Why me? I said. Why can't you pay someone here to go? I'll pay for it if it's a matter of money. It isn't about money, Amir, Rahim Khan roared. I'm a dying man, and I will not be insulted. It has never been about money with me, and you know that. And why you? I think we both know why it has to be you, don't we? I didn't want to understand that comment, but I did. I understood it all too well. I have a wife in America, a home, a career, and a family, I said. Kabul is a dangerous place, you know that. And you'd have me risk everything for... I stopped. You know, Rahim Khan said, one time when you weren't around, your father and I were talking. And you know how he always worried about you in those days. I remember he said to me, Rahim, a boy who won't stand up for himself becomes a man who can't stand up to anything. I wonder, is that what you've become? I dropped my eyes. What I'm asking from you is to grant an old man his dying wish, he said gravely. He had gambled with that comment, played his best card, or so I thought then. His words hung in limbo between us, but at least he'd known what to say. I was still searching for the right words, and I was the writer in the room. Finally, I settled for this. Maybe Baba was right. I'm sorry you think that, Amir. I couldn't look at him. And you don't? If I did, he said, I would not have asked you to come here. I toyed with my wedding ring. You've always thought too highly of me, Rahim Khan. And you have always been far too hard on yourself, he said. He hesitated. But there's something else. Something you don't know. Please, Rahim Khan. Sanobar wasn't Ali's first wife, he said. Now I looked up. He was married once before, to a Hazara woman from the Jaghori area. This was long before you were born. They were married for 3 years. What does this have to do with anything? I said. She left them childless after 3 years and married a man in Khost. She bore him 3 daughters. That's what I'm trying to tell you. I began to see where he was going, but I didn't want to hear the rest of it. I had a good life in California, pretty Victorian home with a peaked roof, a good marriage, a promising writing career, in-laws who loved me. I didn't need any of this shit. Ali was sterile, Rahim Khan said. No, he wasn't. He and Sanobar had Hassan, didn't they? They had Hassan. No, they didn't, Rahim Khan said. Yes, they did. No, they didn't, Amir. Then who? I think you know who. I felt like a man sliding down a steep cliff, clutching at shrubs and tangles of brambles and coming up empty-handed. The room was sweeping up and down and swaying side to side. Did Hassan know? I said through lips that didn't feel like my own. Rahim Khan closed his eyes, shook his head. You bastards! I muttered. I stood up. You goddamn bastards! I screamed. All of you, you bunch of lying goddamn bastards! Please sit down, Rahim Khan said. How could you hide this from me? From him! I bellowed. Please think, Amir John. It was a shameful situation. People would talk. All that a man had back then, all that he was his honor, his name. And if people talked, we couldn't tell anyone. Surely you can see that. He reached for me, but I shut his hand, headed for the door. Amir John, please don't leave. I opened the door and turned to him. Why? What can you possibly say to me? I'm 38 years old, and I've just found out my whole life is one big fucking lie. What can you possibly say to make things better? Nothing. Not a goddamn thing. And with that, I stormed out of the apartment. The sun had almost set and left the sky swathed in smothers of purple and red. I walked down the busy, narrow street that led away from Rahim Khan's building. The street was a noisy lane in a maze of alleyways choked with pedestrians, bicycles, and rickshaws. Billboards hung at its corners, advertising Coca-Cola and cigarettes. Lollywood movie posters displayed sultry actresses dancing with handsome, brown-skinned men in fields of marigolds. I walked into a smoky little samovar house and ordered a cup of tea. I tilted back on the folding chair's rear legs and rubbed my face. That feeling of sliding toward a fall was fading. But in its stead, I felt like a man who awakens in his own house and finds all the furniture rearranged, so that every familiar nook and cranny looks foreign now. Disoriented, he has to reevaluate his surroundings, reorient himself. How could I have been so blind? The signs had been there for me to see all along. They came flying back at me now. Baba hiring Dr. Kumar to fix Hassan's hair lip. Baba never missing Hassan's birthday. I remembered the day we were planting tulips, when I had asked Baba if he would ever consider getting new servants. Hassan's not going anywhere, he had barked. He's staying right here with us, where he belongs. This is his home, and we're his family. He had wept when Ali announced he and Hassan were leaving us. The waiter placed a teacup on the table before me, where the table's legs crossed like an X. There was a ring of brass balls, each walnut-sized. One of the balls had come unscrewed. I stooped and tightened it. I wished I could fix my own life as easily. I took a gulp of the blackest tea I had had in years and tried to think of Surayya, of the general and Khala Jamila, of the novel that needed finishing. I tried to watch the traffic bolting by on the street, the people milling in and out of the little sweet shops. Tried to listen to the Qawwali music playing on the transistor radio at the next table. Anything. But I kept seeing Baba on the night of my graduation, sitting in the fort he had just given me, smelling of beer, and saying, "I wish Hassan had been with us today." How could he have lied to me all those years? To Hassan? He had sat me on his lap when I was little, looked me straight in the eyes, and said, "There's only one sin, and that is theft. When you tell a lie, you steal someone's right to the truth." Hadn't he said those words to me? And now, 15 years after I had buried him, I was learning that Baba had been a thief. And a thief of the worst kind. Because the things he had stolen had been sacred. From me, the right to know I had a brother. From Hassan, his identity. And from Ali, his honor. His nang. His namus. The questions kept coming at me. How had Baba brought himself to look Ali in the eye? How had Ali lived in that house, day in and day out, knowing he had been dishonored by his master in the single worst way an Afghan man can be dishonored? And how was I going to reconcile this new image of Baba with the one that had been imprinted on my mind for so long? That of him in his old brown suit, hobbling up the Tahiri's driveway to ask for Suraya's hand. Here's another cliche my creative writing teacher would have scoffed at. Like father, like son. But it was true, wasn't it? As it turned out, Baba and I were more alike than I had ever known. We had both betrayed the people who would have given their lives for us. And with that came this realization, that Rahim Khan had summoned me here to atone not just for my sins, but for Baba's too. Rahim Khan said I had always been too hard on myself, but I wondered. True, I hadn't made Ali step on the landmine, and I hadn't brought the Taliban to the house to shoot Hassan. But, burdened with guilt over what I had done to Hassan, I had driven him and Ali out of the house. Was it too far-fetched to imagine that things might have turned out differently if I hadn't? Maybe Baba would have brought them along to America. Maybe Hassan would have had a home of his own now, a job, a family. A life in a country where no one cared that he was a Hazara, where most people didn't even know what a Hazara was. Maybe not, but maybe so. "I can't go to Kabul," I had said to Rahim Khan. "I have a wife in America, a home, a career, and a family. But how could I pack up and go back home when my actions may have cost Hassan a chance at those very same things?" I wished Rahim Khan hadn't called me. I wished he had let me live on in my oblivion. But he had called me. And what Rahim Khan revealed to me changed things. Made me see how my entire life, long before the winter of 1975, dating back to when that singing Hazara woman was still nursing me, had been a cycle of lies, betrayals, and secrets. "There's a way to be good again," he had said. "A way to end the cycle. With a little boy, an orphan, Hassan's son, somewhere in Kabul." On the rickshaw ride back to Rahim Khan's apartment, I remembered Baba saying that my problem was that someone had always done my fighting for me. I was 38 now. My hair was receding and streaked with gray, and lately I had traced little crow's feet etched around the corners of my eyes. I was older now, but maybe not yet too old to start doing my own fighting. Baba had lied about a lot of things, as it turned out. but he hadn't lied about that. I looked at the round face in the Polaroid again, the way the sun fell on it. My brother's face. Hassan had loved me once, loved me in a way that no one ever had or ever would again. He was gone now, but a little part of him lived on. It was in Kabul, waiting. I found Rahim Khan praying namaz in a corner of the room. He was just a dark silhouette bowing westward against the blood-red sky. I waited for him to finish. Then I told him I was going to Kabul. Told him to call the Caldwells in the morning. "I'll pray for you, Amir John," he said. Again, the car sickness. By the time we drove past the bullet-riddled sign that read, "The Khaybar Pass welcomes you," my mouth had begun to water. Something inside my stomach churned and twisted. Farid, my driver, threw me a cold glance. There was no empathy in his eyes. "Can we roll down the window?" I asked. He lit a cigarette and tucked it between the remaining two fingers of his left hand, the one resting on the steering wheel. Keeping his black eyes on the road, he stooped forward, picked up the screwdriver lying between his feet, and handed it to me. I stuck it in the small hole in the door where the handle belonged and turned it to roll down my window. Farid gave me another dismissive look, this one with a hint of barely suppressed animosity, and went back to smoking his cigarette. He hadn't said more than a dozen words since we had departed from Jamrud Fort. "Tashakur," I muttered. I leaned my head out of the window and let the cold mid-afternoon air rush past my face. The drive through the tribal lands of the Khaybar Pass, winding between cliffs of shale and limestone, was just as I remembered it. Baba and I had driven through the broken terrain back in 1974. The arid, imposing mountains sat along deep gorges and soared to jagged peaks. Old fortresses, adobe-walled and crumbling, topped the crags. I tried to keep my eyes glued to the snow-capped Hindu Kush on the north side, but each time my stomach settled even a bit, the truck bucked and skidded around another turn, rousing a fresh wave of nausea. "Try a lemon," Farid said. "What?" "Lemon. Good for the sickness," he said. "I always bring one for this drive." "Nay, thank you," I said. The mere thought of adding acidity to my stomach stirred more nausea. Farid snickered. "It's not fancy like American medicine, I know. Just an old remedy my mother taught me." I regretted blowing my chance to warm up to him. "In that case, maybe you should give me some." He grabbed the paperback from the back seat and plucked a half lemon out of it. I bit down on it, waited a few minutes. "You were right, I feel better," I lied. As an Afghan, I knew it was better to be miserable than rude. I forced a weak smile. "Old Watani trick. No need for fancy medicine," he said. His tone bordered on the surly. He flicked the ash off his cigarette and gave himself a self-satisfied look in the rearview mirror. He was a Tajik, a lanky dark man with a weather-beaten face, narrow shoulders, and a long neck punctuated by a protruding Adam's apple that only peeked from behind his beard when he turned his head. He was dressed much as I was, though I suppose it was really the other way around. A rough woven wool blanket wrapped over a gray Piran Tomban and a vest. On his head, he wore a brown pakol, tilted slightly to one side, like the Tajik hero Ahmad Shah Massoud, referred to by Tajiks as the Lion of Panjshir. It was Rahim Khan who had introduced me to Farid in Peshawar. He told me Farid was 29, though he had the wary, lined face of a man 20 years older. He was born in Mazar-e-Sharif and lived there until his father moved the family to Jalalabad when Farid was 10. At 14, he and his father had joined the jihad against the Shorawi. They had fought in the Panjshir Valley for 2 years, until helicopter gunfire had torn the older man to pieces. Farid had 2 wives and 5 children. "He used to have 7, Rahim Khan said with a rueful look, "but he had lost his 2 youngest girls a few years earlier in a landmine blast just outside Jalalabad, the same explosion that had severed toes from his feet and three fingers from his left hand. After that, he had moved his wives and children to Peshawar. "Checkpoint," Farid grumbled. I slumped a little in my seat, arms folded across my chest, forgetting for a moment about the nausea. But I needn't have worried. Two Pakistani militia approached our dilapidated land cruiser, took a cursory glance inside, and waved us on. Farid was first on the list of preparations Rahim Khan and I made, a list that included exchanging dollars for Kaldor and Afghani bills, my garment and pakol. Ironically, I had never worn either when I was actually living in Afghanistan, the Polaroid of Hassan and Sohrab, and finally, perhaps the most important item, an artificial beard, black and chest-length, Sharia-friendly, or at least the Taliban version of Sharia. Rahim Khan knew of a fellow in Peshawar who specialized in weaving them, sometimes for Western journalists who covered the war. Rahim Khan had wanted me to stay with him a few more days, to plan more thoroughly. But I knew I had to leave as soon as possible. I was afraid I would change my mind. I was afraid I would deliberate, ruminate, agonize, rationalize, and talk myself into not going. I was afraid the appeal of my life in America would draw me back, that I would wade back into that great big river and let myself forget, let the things I had learned these last few days sink to the bottom. I was afraid that I'd let the waters carry me away from what I had to do, from Hassan, from the past that had come calling, and from this one last chance at redemption. So I left before there was any possibility of that happening. As for Suraya, telling her I was going back to Afghanistan was not an option. If I had, she would have booked herself on the next flight to Pakistan. We had crossed the border, and the signs of poverty were everywhere. On either side of the road, I saw chains of little villages sprouting here and there, like discarded toys among the rocks, broken mud houses and huts consisting of little more than four wooden poles and a tattered cloth as a roof. I saw children dressed in rags chasing a soccer ball outside the huts. A few miles later, I spotted a cluster of men sitting on their haunches, like a row of crows, on the carcass of an old burnt-out Soviet tank, the wind fluttering the edges of the blankets thrown around them. Behind them, a woman in a brown burqa carried a large clay pot on her shoulder, down a rutted path toward a string of mud houses. "Strange," I said. "What?" Farid said. "I feel like a tourist in my own country," I said, taking in a goat herd leading a half dozen emaciated goats along the side of the road. Farid snickered, tossed his cigarette. "You still think of this place as your country?" "I think a part of me always will," I said, more defensively than I had intended. "After 20 years of living in America," he said, swerving the truck to avoid a pothole the size of a beach ball. I nodded. "I grew up in Afghanistan." Farid snickered again. "Why do you do that?" I said.
"Never mind," he murmured.
"No, I want to know, why do you do that?" In his rearview mirror, I saw something flash in his eyes. "You want to know?" he sneered. "Let me imagine, Agha Sahib. You probably lived in a big two- or three-story house with a nice backyard that your gardener filled with flowers and fruit trees. All gated, of course. Your father drove an American car. You had servants, probably Hazaras. Your parents hired workers to decorate the house for the fancy mehmonis they threw, so their friends would come over to drink and boast about their travels to Europe or America. And I would bet my first son's eyes that this is the first time you've ever worn a pakol." He grinned at me, revealing a mouthful of prematurely rotting teeth. "Am I close?" "Why are you saying these things?" I said. "Because you wanted to know," he spat. He pointed to an old man dressed in ragged clothes trudging down a dirt path, a large burlap pack filled with scrub grass tied to his back. "That's the real Afghanistan, Agha Sahib. That's the Afghanistan I know. You? You've always been a tourist here. You just didn't know it."
Rahim Khan had warned me not to expect a warm welcome in Afghanistan from those who had stayed behind and fought the wars. "I'm sorry about your father," I said. "I'm sorry about your daughters, and I'm sorry about your hand." "That means nothing to me," he said. He shook his head. "Why are you coming back here anyway? Sell off your Baba's land? Pocket the money and run back to your mother in America?" "My mother died giving birth to me," I said. He sighed and lit another cigarette. Said nothing. "Pull over," I said. "What?" "Pull over, goddammit," I said. "I'm going to be sick." I tumbled out of the truck as it was coming to a rest on the gravel alongside the road. By late afternoon, the terrain had changed from one of sun-beaten peaks and barren cliffs to a greener, more rural landscape. The main pass had descended from Landi Kotal through Shenwari territory to Landi Khona. We had entered Afghanistan at Torkham. Pine trees flanked the road, fewer than I remembered and many of them bare, but it was good to see trees again after the arduous drive through the Khaibar Pass. We were getting closer to Jalalabad, where Farid had a brother who would take us in for the night. The sun hadn't quite set when we drove into Jalalabad, capital of the state of Nangarhar, a city once renowned for its fruits and warm climate. Farid drove past the buildings and stone houses of the city's central district. There weren't as many palm trees there as I remembered, and some of the homes had been reduced to roofless walls and piles of twisted clay. Farid turned onto a narrow, unpaved road and parked the Land Cruiser along a dried gutter. I slid out of the truck, stretched, and took a deep breath. In the old days, the winds swept through the irrigated plains around Jalalabad where farmers grew sugarcane and impregnated the city's air with a sweet scent. I closed my eyes and searched for the sweetness. I didn't find it. "Let's go," Farid said impatiently. We walked up the dirt road past a few leafless poplars along a row of broken mud walls. Farid led me to a dilapidated one-story house and knocked on the wood plank door. A young woman with ocean-green eyes and a white scarf draped around her face peeked out. She saw me first, flinched, spotted Farid, and her eyes lit up. "Salam alaikum, Koko Farid," she said. "Salam, Mariam John," Farid replied and gave her something he had denied me all day, a warm smile. He planted a kiss on the top of her head. The young woman stepped out of the way, eyeing me a little apprehensively as I followed Farid into the small house. The adobe ceiling was low, the dirt walls entirely bare, and the only light came from a pair of lanterns set in a corner. We took off our shoes and stepped on a straw mat that covered the floor. Along one of the walls sat three young boys, cross-legged, on a mattress covered with a blanket with shredded borders. A tall bearded man with broad shoulders stood up to greet us. Farid and he hugged and kissed on the cheek. Farid introduced him to me as Wahid, his older brother. "He's from America," he said to Wahid, flicking his thumb toward me. He left us alone and went to greet the boys. Wahid sat with me against the wall across from the boys, who had ambushed Farid and climbed his shoulders. Despite my protests, Wahid ordered one of the boys to fetch another blanket so I would be more comfortable on the floor, and asked Mariam to bring me some tea. He asked about the ride from Peshawar, the drive over the Khaibar Pass. "I hope you didn't come across any dozds," he said. The Khaibar Pass was as famous for its terrain as for the bandits who used that terrain to rob travelers. Before I could answer, he winked and said in a loud voice, "Of course, no dozd would waste his time on a car as ugly as my brother's." Farid wrestled the smallest of the three boys to the floor and tickled him on the ribs with his good hand. The kid giggled and kicked. "At least I have a car," Farid panted. "How is your donkey these days?" "My donkey is a better ride than your car," laughed Wahid. "Kharkhara mishnasa," Farid shot back. "Takes a donkey to know a donkey." They all laughed and I joined in. I heard female voices from the adjoining room. I could see half of the room from where I sat. Mariam and an older woman wearing a brown hijab, presumably her mother, were speaking in low voices and pouring tea from a kettle into a pot. "So what do you do in America, Amir Agha?" Wahid asked. "I'm a writer," I said. I thought I heard Farid chuckle at that. "A writer," Wahid said, clearly impressed. "Do you write about Afghanistan?" "Well, I have, but not currently," I said. My last novel, A Season for Ashes, had been about a university professor who joins a clan of bohemians after he finds his wife in bed with one of his students. It wasn't a bad book. Some reviewers had called it a good book, and one had even used the word riveting. But suddenly, I was embarrassed by it. I hoped Wahid wouldn't ask what it was about. "Maybe you should write about Afghanistan again," Wahid said. "Tell the rest of the world what the Taliban are doing to our country." "Well, I'm not quite that kind of writer," I said. "Oh," Wahid said, nodding and blushing a bit. "You know best, of course. It's not for me to suggest." Just then, Mariam and the other woman came into the room with a pair of cups and a teapot on a small platter. I stood up in respect, pressed my hand to my chest, and bowed my head. "Salaam alaikum," I said. The woman, who had now wrapped her hijab to conceal her lower face, bowed her head too. "Salaam," she replied, in a barely audible voice. We never made eye contact. She poured the tea while I stood. The woman placed a steaming cup of tea before me and exited the room, her bare feet making no sound at all as she disappeared. I sat down and sipped the strong black tea. Wahid finally broke the uneasy silence that followed. "So, what brings you back to Afghanistan?" "What brings them all back to Afghanistan, dear brother?" Farid said, speaking to Wahid but fixing me with a contemptuous gaze. "Bas!" Wahid snapped. "It's always the same thing," Farid said. "Sell this land, sell that house, collect the money, and run away like a mouse. Go back to America and spend the money on a family vacation to Mexico." "Farid!" Wahid roared. His children, and even Farid, flinched. "Have you forgotten your manners? This is my house. Amir Agha is my guest tonight, and I will not allow you to dishonor me like this." Farid opened his mouth, almost said something, reconsidered, and said nothing. He slumped against the wall, muttered something under his breath, and crossed his mutilated foot over the good one. His accusing eyes never left me. "Forgive us, Amir Agha," Wahid said. "Since childhood, my brother's mouth has been two steps ahead of his head." "It's my fault, really," I said, trying to smile under Farid's intense gaze. "I'm not offended. I should have explained to him my business here in Afghanistan. I'm not here to sell property. I'm going to Kabul to find a boy." "A boy?" Wahid repeated. "Yes," I said. I fished the Polaroid from the pocket of my shirt. Seeing Hassan's picture again tore the fresh scab off his death. I had to turn my eyes away from it. I gave it to Wahid. He studied the photo, looked from me to the photo and back again. "This boy?" I nodded. "This Hazara boy," he said. "Yes," I said. "What does he mean to you?" "His father meant a lot to me. He is the man in the photo. He's dead now." Wahid blinked. "He was a friend of yours?" My instinct was to say yes, as if, on some deep level, I too wanted to protect Baba's secret. But there had been enough lies already. "He was my half-brother," I swallowed and added, "my illegitimate half-brother." I turned the teacup and toyed with the handle. "I didn't mean to pry," Wahid said. "You're not prying," I said. "What will you do with him?" "Take him back to Peshawar. There are people there who will take care of him." Wahid handed the photo back and rested his thick hand on my shoulder. "You're an honorable man, Amir Agha," A true Afghan. I cringed inside. I am proud to have you in our home tonight, Wahid said. I thanked him and chanced a glance over to Farid. He was looking down now, playing with the frayed edges of the straw mat. A short while later, Maryam and her mother brought two steaming bowls of vegetable shorwa and two loaves of bread. I'm sorry we can't offer you meat, Wahid said. Only the Taliban can afford meat now. This looks wonderful, I said. It did, too. I offered some to him, to the kids, but Wahid said the family had eaten before we arrived. Farid and I rolled up our sleeves, dipped our bread in the shorwa, and ate with our hands. As I ate, I noticed Wahid's boys, all three of them thin with dirt-caked faces and short-cropped brown hair under their skullcaps. They were stealing furtive glances at my digital wristwatch. The youngest whispered something in his brother's ear. The brother nodded and didn't take his eyes off my watch. The oldest of the boys, I guessed his age at about 12, rocked back and forth, his gaze glued to my wrist. After dinner, after I had washed my hands with the water Maryam poured from a clay pot, I asked for Wahid's permission to give his boys a hadiah, a gift. He said no, but when I insisted, he reluctantly agreed. I unsnapped the wristwatch and gave it to the youngest of the three boys. He muttered a sheepish tashakur. It tells you the time in any city in the world, I told him. The boys nodded politely, passing the watch between them, taking turns trying it on. But they lost interest, and soon the watch sat abandoned on the straw mat. You could have told me, Farid said later. The two of us were lying next to each other on the straw cots Wahid's wife had spread for us. Told you what? Why you've come to Afghanistan, he said. His voice had lost the rough edge I had heard in it since the moment I had met him. Well, you didn't ask, I said. You should have told me, he said. You didn't ask. He rolled to face me, curled his arm under his head. Maybe I will help you find this boy. Thank you, Farid, I said. It was wrong of me to assume, he said. I sighed. Don't worry. You are more right than you know. His hands are tied behind him with roughly woven rope cutting through the flesh of his wrists. He is blindfolded with black cloth. He is kneeling on the street, on the edge of a gutter filled with still water, his head drooping between his shoulders. His knees roll on the hard ground and bleed through his pants as he rocks in prayer. It is late afternoon, and his long shadow sways back and forth on the gravel. He is muttering something under his breath. I step closer. 1,000 times over, he mutters. For you, 1,000 times over. Back and forth, he rocks. He lifts his face. I see a faint scar above his upper lip. We are not alone. I see the barrel first, then the man standing behind him. He is tall, dressed in a herringbone vest and a black turban. He looks down at the blindfolded man before him with eyes that show nothing but a vast, cavernous emptiness. He takes a step back and raises the barrel, places it on the back of the kneeling man's head. For a moment, fading sunlight catches in the metal and twinkles. The rifle roars with a deafening crack. I follow the barrel on its upward arc. I see the face behind the plume of smoke swirling from the muzzle. I am the man in the herringbone vest. I woke up with a scream trapped in my throat. I stepped outside, stood in the silver tarnish of a half moon, and glanced up to a sky riddled with stars. Crickets chirped in the shuttered darkness, and a wind wafted through the trees. The ground was cool under my bare feet, and suddenly, for the first time since we had crossed the border, I felt like I was back. After all these years, I was home again, standing on the soil of my ancestors. This was the soil on which my great-grandfather had married his third wife a year before dying in the cholera epidemic that hit Kabul in 1915. She had borne him what his first two wives had failed to, a son at last. It was on this soil that my grandfather had gone on a hunting trip with King Nader Shah and shot a deer. My mother had died on this soil. And on this soil, I had fought for my father's love. I sat against one of the house's clay walls. The kinship I felt suddenly for the old land, it surprised me. I had been gone long enough to forget and be forgotten. I had a home in a land that might as well be in another galaxy to the people sleeping on the other side of the wall I leaned against. I thought I had forgotten about this land, but I hadn't. And under the bony glow of a half moon, I sensed Afghanistan humming under my feet. Maybe Afghanistan hadn't forgotten me either. I looked westward and marveled that somewhere over those mountains, Kabul still existed. It really existed, not just as an old memory or as the heading of an AP story on page 15 of the San Francisco Chronicle. Somewhere over those mountains in the west slept the city where my hair-lipped brother and I had run kites. Somewhere over there, the blindfolded man from my dream had died a needless death. Once, over those mountains, I had made a choice. And now, a quarter of a century later, that choice had landed me right back on this soil. I was about to go back inside when I heard voices coming from the house. I recognized them as Wahid and his wife. "Nothing left for the children," she was saying. "We're hungry, but we're not savages. He's a guest. What was I supposed to do?" he said in a strained voice. "Have to find something tomorrow," she sounded near tears. "What do I feed them?" I tiptoed away. I understood now why the boys had not shown any interest in the watch. They hadn't been staring at the watch at all. They had been staring at my food. We said our goodbyes early the next morning. Just before I climbed into the Land Cruiser, I thanked Wahid for his hospitality. He pointed to the little house behind him. "This is your home," he said. His three sons were standing in the doorway, watching us. The little one was wearing the watch. It dangled around his twiggy wrist. I glanced in the side-view mirror as we pulled away. Wahid stood surrounded by his boys in a cloud of dust whipped up by the truck. It occurred to me that in a different world, those boys would not have been too hungry to chase after the car. Earlier that morning, when I was certain no one was looking, I did something I had done 26 years earlier. I planted a fistful of crumpled money under a mattress. Farid had warned me. He had. But as it turned out, he had wasted his breath. We were driving down the cratered road that winds from Jalalabad to Kabul. The last time I had traveled that road was in a tarpaulin-covered truck going the other way. Baba had nearly gotten himself shot by a singing stoned Rusi officer. Baba had made me so mad that night, so scared, and ultimately so proud. The trek between Kabul and Jalalabad, a bone-jarring ride down a teetering pass snaking through the rocks, had become a relic now, a relic of two wars. 20 years earlier, I had seen some of the first war with my own eyes. Grim reminders of it were strewn along the road. Burned carcasses of old Soviet tanks. Overturned military trucks gone to rust. A crushed Russian jeep that had plunged over the mountainside. The second war I had watched on my TV screen, and now I was seeing it through Farid's eyes. Swerving effortlessly around potholes in the middle of the broken road, Farid was a man in his element. He had become much chattier since our overnight stay at Wahid's house. He had me sit in the passenger seat and looked at me when he spoke. He even smiled once or twice. Maneuvering the steering wheel with his mangled hand, He pointed to mud hut villages along the way where he had known people years before. "Most of those people," he said, "were either dead or in refugee camps in Pakistan. And sometimes the dead are luckier," he said. He pointed to the crumbled, charred remains of a tiny village. It was just a tuft of blackened, roofless walls now. I saw a dog sleeping along one of the walls. "I had a friend there once," Farid said. "He was a very good bicycle repairman. He played the tabla well, too. The Taliban killed him and his family and burned the village. We drove past the village, and the dog didn't move." In the old days, the drive from Jalalabad to Kabul took 2 hours, maybe a little more. It took Farid and me 6 hours to reach Kabul. And when we did, Farid warned me just after we passed the Mohipar Dam. "Kabul is not the way you remember it," he said. "So I hear." Farid gave me a look that said hearing is not the same as seeing, and he was right. Because when Kabul finally did unroll before us, I was certain, absolutely certain, that he had taken a wrong turn somewhere. Farid must have seen my stupefied expression. Shuttling people back and forth to Kabul, he would have become familiar with that expression on the faces of those who had not seen Kabul for a long time. He patted me on the shoulder. "Welcome back," he said morosely. Rubble and beggars. Everywhere I looked, that was what I saw. I remembered beggars in the old days too. Baba always carried an extra handful of Afghani bills in his pocket just for them. I had never seen him deny a peddler. Now, though, they squatted at every street corner, dressed in shredded burlap rags, mud-caked hands held out for a coin. And the beggars were mostly children now, thin and grim-faced, some no older than 5 or 6. They sat in the laps of their burqa-clad mothers alongside gutters at busy street corners and chanted for bakhshish, bakhshish. And something else, something I hadn't noticed right away. Hardly any of them sat with an adult male. The wars had made fathers a rare commodity in Afghanistan. We were driving westbound toward the Kartese district on what I remembered as a major thoroughfare in the 70s, Jade Maiwand. Just north of us was the bone-dry Kabul River. On the hills to the south stood the broken old city wall. Just east of it was the Bala Hisar Fort, the ancient citadel that the warlord Dostum had occupied in 1992, on the Shirdawaza mountain range, the same mountains from which Gulbuddin's forces had showered Kabul with rockets between 1992 and 1996, inflicting much of the damage I was witnessing now. The Shirdawaza mountain range stretched all the way west. It was from those mountains that I remembered the firing of the Topichasht, the noon cannon. It went off every day to announce noontime, and also to signal the end of daylight fasting during the month of Ramadan. You would hear the roar of that cannon all through the city in those days. "I used to come here to Jade Maiwand when I was a kid," I mumbled. "There used to be shops here and hotels, neon lights and restaurants. I used to buy kites from an old man named Saifo, who ran a little kite shop by the old police headquarters." "The police headquarters is still there," Farid said. "No shortage of police in this city. But you won't find kites or kite shops on Jade Maiwand or anywhere else in Kabul. Those days are over." Jade Maiwand had turned into a giant sandcastle. The buildings that had not entirely collapsed barely stood, with caved-in roofs and walls pierced with rocket shells. Entire blocks had been obliterated to rubble. I saw a bullet-pocked sign half buried at an angle in a heap of debris. It read, "Drink Coca-Cola." I saw children playing in the ruins of a windowless building amid jagged stumps of brick and stone. Bicycle riders and mule-drawn carts swerved around kids, stray dogs, and piles of debris. A haze of dust hovered over the city, and across the river, a single plume of smoke rose to the sky. "Where are the trees?" I said. "People cut them down for firewood in the winter," Farid said. "The Shorawi cut a lot of them down too."
"Why?"
I said. "Snipers used to hide in them," he said. A sadness came over me. Returning to Kabul was like running into an old forgotten friend and seeing that life had not been good to him, that he had become homeless and destitute. "My father built an orphanage in Sharikuna, the old city south of here," I said.
"I remember it," Farid said. "It was destroyed a few years ago."
"Can you pull over?" I said. "I want to take a quick walk here." Farid parked along the curb on a small back street next to a ramshackle abandoned building with no door. "That used to be a pharmacy," Farid muttered as we exited the truck. We walked back to Jode Maiwand and turned right, heading west.
"What's that smell?" I said.
Something was making my eyes water.
"Diesel," Farid replied. "The city's generators are always going down, so electricity is unreliable. People use diesel fuel for energy."
"Diesel," I said. "Remember what the street smelled like in the old days?"
Farid smiled. "Kebab."
"Lamb kebab," I said.
"Lamb," Farid said,
tasting the word in his mouth. "The only people in Kabul who get to eat lamb now are the Taliban." He pulled on my sleeve.
"Speaking of which," he said, "a vehicle was approaching us."
"Beard patrol," Farid murmured. That was the first time I saw the Taliban. I had seen them on TV, on the internet, on the cover of magazines and in newspapers. But here I was now, less than 50 feet from them, telling myself that the sudden taste in my mouth was not unadulterated naked fear. Telling myself my flesh hadn't suddenly shrunk against my bones and my heart wasn't battering. Here they came, in all their glory. The red Toyota pickup truck idled past us. A handful of stern-faced young men sat on their haunches in the cab, Kalashnikovs slung on their shoulders. They all wore beards and black turbans. One of them, a dark-skinned man in his early 20s with thick knitted eyebrows, twirled a whip in his hand and rhythmically swatted the side of the truck with it. His roaming eyes fell on me, held my gaze. I had never felt so naked in my entire life. Then the Talib spat tobacco-stained spittle and looked away. I found I could breathe again. The truck rolled down Jode Maiwand, leaving in its trail a cloud of dust.
"What is the matter with you?" Farid hissed.
"What? Don't ever stare at them. Do you understand me? Never."
"I didn't mean to," I said.
"Your friend is quite right, Aga. You might as well poke a rabid dog with a stick," someone said. This new voice belonged to an old beggar sitting barefoot on the steps of a bullet-scarred building. He wore a threadbare chapan worn to frayed shreds and a dirt-crusted turban. His left eyelid drooped over an empty socket. With an arthritic hand, he pointed to the direction the red truck had gone. "They drive around looking," he said, "looking and hoping that someone will provoke them. And sooner or later, someone always obliges. Then the dogs feast and the day's boredom is broken at last, and everyone says, 'Allahu Akbar.' And on those days when no one offends, well, there's always random violence, isn't there?"
"Keep your eyes on your feet when the Talibs are near," Farid said.
"Your friend dispenses good advice," the old beggar chimed in. He barked a wet cough and spat in a soiled handkerchief. "Forgive me, but could you spare a few afghanis?" he breathed.
"Bas, let's go," Farid said, pulling me by the arm.
I handed the old man 100,000 afghanis, or the equivalent of about $3. When he leaned forward to take the money, his stench, like sour milk and feet that had not been washed in weeks, flooded my nostrils and made my gorge rise. He hurriedly slipped the money in his waist, his lone eye darting side to side. "A world of thanks for your benevolence, Agha Sahib," he said. "Do you know where the orphanage is in Kartese?" I said. "It's not hard to find. It's just west of Darul Amon Boulevard," he said. "The children were moved from here to Kartese after the rockets hit the old orphanage, which is like saving someone from the lion's cage and throwing them in the tigers." "Thank you, Agha," I said. I turned to go. "That was your first time, nay?" he said. "I'm sorry?" "The first time you saw a talib." I said nothing. The old beggar nodded and smiled. He revealed a handful of remaining teeth, all crooked and yellow. "I remember the first time I saw them rolling into Kabul. What a joyous day that was," he said. "An end to the killing, wah wah. But like the poet says, how seamless seemed love, and then came trouble." A smile sprouted on my face. "I know that, Ghazal," I said. "That's Hafez." "Yes, it is, indeed," the old man replied. "I should know. I used to teach it at the university." "You did?" The old man buried his fists in his armpits and coughed. "From 1958 to 1996, I taught Hafez, Khayyam, Rumi, Bedel, Jami, Sadi. Once, I was even a guest lecturer in Tehran, 1971 that was. I gave a lecture on the mystic Bedel. I remember how they all stood and clapped. Ah." He shook his head. "But you saw those young men in the truck. What value do you think they see in Sufism?" "My mother taught at the university," I said. "And what was her name?" "Sufia Akrami." His eye managed to twinkle under the veil of cataracts. "The desert weed lives on, but the flower of spring blooms and wilts. Such grace, such dignity, such a tragedy," he said. "You knew my mother?" I asked, kneeling before the old man. "Oh yes, indeed," the old beggar said. "We used to sit to talk. The last time was on a rainy day just before final exams, when we shared a marvelous slice of almond cake together. Almond cake with hot tea and honey. She was rather obviously pregnant by then, and all the more beautiful for it. I will never forget what she said to me that day." "What?" I said. "Please tell me." Baba had always described my mother to me in broad strokes, like she was a great woman. But what I had always thirsted for were the details. The way her hair glinted in the sunlight, her favorite ice cream flavor, the songs she liked to hum. Did she bite her nails? Baba took his memories of her to the grave with him. Maybe speaking her name would have reminded him of his guilt, of what he had done so soon after she had died. Or maybe his loss had been so great, his pain so deep, he couldn't bear to talk about her. Maybe both. She said, "I'm so afraid," the beggar said. And I said, "Why?" And she said, "Because I'm so profoundly happy, Dr. Rasul. Happiness like this is frightening." I asked her why, and she said, "They only let you be this happy if they're preparing to take something from you." And I said, "Hush up now. Enough of this silliness." Farid took my arm. "We should go, Amir Agha," he said softly. I snatched my arm away. "What else? What else did she say?" The old man's features softened. "I wish I remembered for you, but I don't. Your mother passed a long time ago, and my memory is as shattered as these buildings. I am sorry." "But even a small thing," I said, "anything at all." The old man smiled. "I'll try to remember, and that's a promise. Come back and find me." "Thank you," I said. "Thank you so much." And I meant it. Now I knew my mother had liked almond cake with honey and hot tea, that she had once used the word profoundly, that she had fretted about her happiness. I had just learned more about my mother from this old man on the street than I ever did from Baba. Walking back to the truck, Neither one of us commented about what most non-Afghans would have seen as an improbable coincidence, that a beggar on the street would happen to know my mother. Because we both knew that in Afghanistan, and particularly in Kabul,